quiet parts. A man like him, they'd call him sly. Yet when we look at Miss O's conditions for a groom, he seems somehow better suited than the decent, slow, and faultless men. Here, honesty and a steady, simple pace define our people, while the cunning ones, they're always strangers from elsewhere. Still, this slyness, through the eyes of someone less pure, can sometimes appear as cleverness, a diligent way of working. A mistress, they say, is a kind of demon. Her thoughts, perhaps, are just as twisted. Honesty, a virtue we hold dear in this land. But that fellow, he's a strange one, never touches alcohol. We, the snow country folk, are bound to our unfiltered sake for life. Yet through the shrewd eyes of an outsider, to pluck the eye from a living horse, that's his game. Truly, one cannot let their guard down. In the countryside, there's the bon dance. This is the good part about country life. Each year, new relationships bloom. That scoundrel, Hanasuke, always flashing his badge and boasting, yet he's such a cheap fellow, insisting there isn't a single woman of pleasure in this village. A man like that is a stain on masculinity, a disgrace to all. Someone good young men would cast out. It's a strange anomaly, impossible unless he's a fool or a cripple. But from the cunning perspective of an outsider, Edo, they say, is where you'd pluck the eyes from a living horse. And that's why these sly fellows appear, making things so complicated. Indeed, a street detective is usually a villain, cunning beyond belief. True to his name, Hanasuke, he must have caught wind of Miss O's search for a groom and left Edo with an evil plot forming in his mind. Being a detective alone wasn't enough to make a living, so Hanasuke took on various jobs. He did things like construction work, like a rigger. Carpentry, well digging, he'd do anything. Sometimes he'd borrow a blacksmith's shop front, or diligently create odd objects whose purpose was unknown. Some even suspected that fellow, while entrusted with a badge. When the young men discovered why Hanasuke was frequenting Otoki's mistress's house, their surprise turned into a paralyzing terror. They couldn't stand still. One day, he visited the mistress's house and declared, "Ah, a specialty of Edo, Japan's finest detective, Hanasuke at your service. How about a background check for the esteemed groom-to-be?" Truly, he was the very founder of Japan's first detective agency. It was only natural that the young men's spirits remained cold, unable to warm up. So, did the people from 10 square miles unite to bravely eliminate Hanasuke? No, because the trouble is, in every country, traitors lurk closest to home. The daughters of every village, as if by prior arrangement, they'd freely confide in Hanasuke, saying, "Tagosaku sneaked into my house 7 times. All the young bachelors, whether Anya or Oncha, so the sisters were seething with anger. Consequently, Hanasuke's information was, as he boasted, accurate and meticulous. Its origin was truly impeccable, coming from sources beyond dispute. So, both the older and younger brothers were thrown into utter panic, frustrated yet utterly powerless. Not a single soul could sleep soundly, with a high pillow and loud snores. The countryside folks, being master calculators, would visit Hanasuke with a money pouch, saying, "It's just a little talk." They'd open the pouch, show him the money they'd give for a good mediation, letting the coins jingle one by one. There wasn't a single cunning fellow who'd leave even a penny as a deposit or bribe. Truly honest indeed, not a speck of it infringed upon national law. What's more, if this were left unchecked, people would mutter, "That scoundrel Hanasuke, drooling buckets. When I put my wallet back in my pocket, damn, he was so shocked. That greedy bastard!" And he would be branded an inferior race, slyer than the slyest. But Hanasuke, being clever, wouldn't let such words be spoken. Then someone would come visiting. Hanasuke's dwelling was a converted shed, so there was no kitchen to speak of, just one single room. "Who is it?" "Well, come in," he'd say, and the door would slide open smoothly. Nasukai, that rascal, sat there, settled firmly before the hearth's hanging pot. I wondered who left the door ajar. My gaze drifted, lost in a silent query. Step inside, can't you hurry? You slow country bumpkin, utterly devoid of manners. It's terribly cold, I can barely stand it. As the guest stepped in, the door whispered closed, a silent, smooth embrace. Nasukai, deep inside, remained still, a stone figure. No other soul was anywhere in sight. Lost in bewilderment, as I stood there blankly, a cushion slid from the corner, stopping neatly before the hearth's pot. Come on, sit down. Don't just stand there, lost in thought. Move quickly, or the day will fade. Look at you, past 20, yet still with a child's understanding. You slow, dullard fool. Then I saw it. The ceiling, the walls, the very tatami beneath me, all laced with countless strings. From every corner, these strings gathered, encircling his form. A pull on these strings, and doors would dance open or closed. Pots and kettles would slide, appearing and vanishing, a strange ballet. On a single wall, a life-sized human diagram, starkly etched. Tiny dots, like acupuncture marks, covered it, hinting at 565 vital points, perhaps. I have something to discuss with you. What? Something to discuss? Everyone, every single one, says the same thing. Is it some fixed greeting here, like good morning or good evening, to say, I have something to discuss? As he spoke from beneath his knee, he took a nail-like object, 3 or 4 inches long, and flicked it casually at the human diagram. The nail struck true, piercing swiftly what seemed a vital point upon the diagram's face. As the guest reached into his kimono's fold, a voice snapped, Stop! Stop! Whatever you pull out from there will be utterly meaningless. Don't waste your time with such trifles. I'm sticking out my tongue at you. Just imagine that instead. Swiftly, he threw another nail. It found its mark, sinking deep into a vital spot. While the guest was still watching, somehow a string was tugged, and the door slid open, soft and smooth. The door is open now. Go home, just go home, he urged, effectively chasing him out. Even for a constable, known for his lack of manners, this repeated insolence was utterly outrageous. To let this continue would be to surrender 10 square ri to the tyranny of a single nasukai. So, the Anya volunteers gathered, their voices low and resolute. If we let that rascal continue, they'll say there are no true men left in this village, and we'll have no reply. Such talk would shame our descendants for generations to come. Precisely, another agreed. We must teach him a lesson, once and for all. And so the decision was made. Though they resolved to teach him a lesson, the way to do it proved elusive. He was full of bluster, yes, but surely possessed some hidden skill. And after over 10 years in Edo, who could say what cunning tricks or wicked schemes he might wield? Among the Anya in nearby villages, one name echoed as the strongest, Onimitsu, the Yokozuna of grass sumo. He was a force of nature, 6 feet 3 inches tall, weighing 38 kan. Even an Edo Ozeki, hit by his iron cannon thrust, would be in grave danger. So said the elders, who rarely praised the young. One could only imagine his power. No one could stand against him. Some were flung so high, crashing against pillars, breaking ribs. Others, caught in his hip throw, had their heads hammered into the earth until they lost their senses, regaining breath, but forever changed, their minds clouded. Some had their leg bones crushed. Countless others, with a single iron cannon strike, were sent flying 5 ken backward, their minds reeling. Onimitsu's iron cannon was sealed, but even then, unless sumo itself was forbidden, the injuries would never end. Now, no one dared to challenge Onimitsu. Not a single soul stepped forward. Next in strength was the sea monk from Gyogyoji Temple. A monk he was, no doubt, but a monstrous, sea-ghost kind of monk, famously known as a mountain man, a formidable man indeed. He could beat bears or badgers to death, and then devour them. His occasional retreats to the mountains, ascetic training, as he called it, were truly to savor that unforgettable taste. From the town, there was the rice shop's Anya, though a rice merchant. He was a master of Maniwa Nenryu, a stand-in instructor for Ishikawa Junhachiro, and a teacher of young samurai, truly a seasoned expert. And one more, Hisaku, from the town fire brigade, a master of brawling. He swaggered through the streets like a true town tough, his shoulders cutting the wind. These four, by all accounts, were the strongest. Ichi Kitsui Mon, as the local tongue named them. Thus, courteous envoys from the Anya volunteers were sent, gathering these four formidable heroes. They gathered simple fare: catfish, loach, pond snails, sparrows, potatoes, daikon, carrots, burdock, humble offerings for a grand feast, complete with a generous second course. The matter, gentlemen, is simple. We see you as the strongest, and we have a single plea. If we don't teach that scoundrel Nasukai a lesson, they'll claim there are no real men for Tenri around. But he is no ordinary man. From my observations, he's the kind who would pluck the eyes from a living horse. Truly a terrifying fellow. So we need your strength, your helping hands. Yet, here's the problem. He's also a minor official carrying a jite, which means we can't simply beat him up just because. At the mention of jite, Onimitsu swallowed hard, the cloudy sake in his throat descending with a gulp, his face a mask of calm, his eyes quietly closed as if nothing had been said. Then, with a knowing glint in his eyes, my younger brother and his wife, they've been talking. They say you can't just keep wrestling sumo forever, you know. You must take a wife and settle down, for it's no good otherwise. Apparently, by next month, a girl from another village is coming to be a bride for our family, so I hear.